Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly health news magazine. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is produced by WFYI Indianapolis in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. I'm Barbara Lewis. Today on Sound Medicine, for some people with traumatic brain injuries, why yoga might help.
Yoga is reestablishing my physical and mental, because when I do it, I have to think about what I'm doing.
Plus, another health issue for women in the military.
There seemed to be a higher incidence of women who had had prior experience of abuse before they ever got into the military.
We'll talk with a neurologist about the new device to prevent migraines.
It looks like Princess Leia's tiara from Star Wars.
A retired surgeon recalls how traumatic it can be when things go wrong.
As I drove, hands so tightly on the wheel that they were getting numb, I was thinking I'd do whatever was in my power to save the kid, do whatever it takes.
And how plastic surgeons in training benefit from an art class.
That connection between their eyes and their hand, I think, is really, really important.
All that and more, plus which commuters are happiest. Next on Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly news magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. Whether it's debate over the role of the American military in the Middle East or how to improve the healthcare system for veterans, the consequences of sending men and women into dangerous situations is on the front pages just about every day. One example? The complex and long-term impact of traumatic brain injuries. Millions of Americans are recovering from TBIs, injuries that are both difficult to live with and expensive to treat. And there's no actual cure for a traumatic brain injury. But Sound Medicine contributor Erica Barris reports on one way that may help ease the impact: yoga. Here's what she found.
And your left toes are going to be pointing towards the mirror. And if you want, you can take this foot a little bit further back. Does that feel okay right here?
On a recent Thursday night, a group of barefoot people are moving through a yoga practice at Bend Yoga's studio in downtown Pittsburgh.
Inhale, arms lift up, stick out your tongue, make a crazy face.
It's a yoga class for people with traumatic brain injuries or post-traumatic stress disorder, or both. People such as Chris Oliger, who says yoga has benefited him in ways no other treatments or therapies have.
Different medicines, and I guess even some physical therapy, it felt more like work and less like healing, less like fixing anything. It was more difficult to maintain. It didn't feel as complete and like as wholesome as this feels, and as motivating, I guess, as this feels.
Oliger, a 29-year-old Army veteran, sustained injuries from blasts while serving in Iraq. A few months ago, some friends started talking up a yoga class they'd been going to at the Wounded Warrior Project's downtown Pittsburgh office. After a lot of urging, he agreed to go. Then he told his wife, Audrey.
I said, "Are you kidding?" Because that's the last place I thought I would see him go.
Jana Leidy taught the class for veterans.
To teach that a Wounded Warrior class, you're a little bit of a different yoga teacher than, say, to go into one of my studios and just teach regular students. You gotta hang with them and kind of play their game.
They didn't initially take to the mat.
Yoga's for girls. Like, yoga's for sissies. Yoga's for, insert a bunch of words I'm not gonna say.
Leidy's Wounded Warrior class ended, but the response she received from her students was so positive.
Tell me that they were sleeping better, that they were, you know, not falling on their face if they closed their eyes, and they'd be like, "Is it the yoga?" I'm like, "I think it might be."
That she started this new class and opened it to all people with brain injuries.
Yoga's weird.
I used to do this in one of my therapies.
Yeah, this is a PT move. Bend your knees. PT's weird too. Bend your knees.
For Jana Leidy, though, working with those who have traumatic brain injuries started closer to home.
Dad? Dad?
Hello.
Hi.
When she was a teenager, Lighty's father, John, sustained a traumatic brain injury in a car accident. His frontal lobe, which affects things such as executive function, was impaired.
To see him, he looks normal. He seems normal, but he couldn't balance a bank account. He couldn't hold a job. He just couldn't do all of those things just because of the injury in his brain. So it was a very challenging way to grow up with that kind of a father. It was a lot of role reversal within a family.
Years later, practicing yoga helped her deal with the emotions she had suppressed around her father's injury. Eventually, she became a yoga teacher. And then on visits to her parents' home in rural Mercer County, she started teaching her father some basic yoga poses she thought might help him.
So, but yeah, this is the first place we ever did yoga, right here. I thought that maybe because it had helped me so much, it could help my father deal with some of the things that all his, basically his therapies, his doctors, his medication, all this stuff we'd been trying for 17 years to like get at, to help him realize he has a brain injury, to help him work with the deficits he has, to help him, you know, just react better emotionally, behaviorally, cognitively. I thought maybe let's give yoga a shot, can't hurt.
Jana's father, John, says while he didn't resist yoga at first, he didn't have expectations for it either.
I thought it was something mystical. I thought it was something that druggies did.
Now, a few years into a regular yoga practice, both father and daughter say it's helped him.
I think there's a disconnection in my injury between my brain, my physical, and my mental. And yoga is reestablishing my physical and mental because when I do it, I have to think about what I'm doing.
Traumatic brain injury affects millions of Americans. They get them from falls, accidents, and sports. And increasingly, soldiers are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with TBI. TBI affects everything from the way you act to the way you move. When Jana Lighty went looking for books that would give her some pointers, she couldn't find any.
You go into a bookstore or Amazon these days and you look up yoga for, and you can find yoga for anything. Yoga for cancer survivors, yoga for domestic abuse, yoga for depression, yoga for sciatica, anything. And I didn't ever find yoga for brain injury.
So she decided to write one herself. The world of traumatic brain injury and yoga is small but growing. Dr. John Rigg is the director of the Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Army Medical Center for active duty soldiers in Fort Gordon, Georgia.
They'll come into our program and they'll see the medical doctor. They'll see behavioral health specialists to deal with mood issues. They'll see physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists to deal with cognitive issues, recreational therapists to help integrate them back into society. If they're not responding to that, they get enrolled in a 3-week-long intensive outpatient program. And it's during that program that they'll get exposed to anywhere from 5 to 6 yoga classes over the course of a couple weeks.
They started teaching yoga to the soldiers 4 years ago, and it took off. Now they have a full-time yoga teacher, a Department of Defense employee, working with the soldiers. He says almost immediately, as soon as they start taking classes, they see results, like better sleep and relaxed neck muscles. And after a few years and about 400 soldiers who have taken the classes at his base alone, it's become a sort of catalyst for change.
There are people that have really gotten a lot out of it. And even for the folks I think that haven't followed up with it, it's been a great introduction of how to use the body movement as a healing force. I think that, you know, it's been an enlightening factor even for people who don't continue in yoga to see that they can use breath and they can use physical movement to actually change the way they feel.
There hasn't been much research on yoga and traumatic brain injury. A couple years ago, researchers at the University of San Francisco and Harvard published a paper on the respiratory, physical, and psychological benefits of breath-focused yoga for adults with severe traumatic brain injury. It's easier to measure things like breath than it is to measure things like empathy. But those who've been taking the classes say it's changed them, even if they don't fully understand what it is about the yoga. When the Wounded Warrior class ended, Chris Oliger started feeling some of the old effects from his injuries returning.
I noticed then, having stopped doing it for a month, I noticed the difference. And not so much when I started, you know, for the first couple sessions, any sustained change, but I really noticed when I was no longer doing it and sort of more tension coming back, more, I guess, anxiety and just kind of stress coming back. Just didn't have that regular release and kind of like regular rehabilitation of doing the yoga.
So he's back at Jana Leidy's class at Bend Yoga and plans to continue going as often as he can.
Erica Barris is a radio journalist based in Pittsburgh, specializing in mental health issues. About 60% of military women say they have received severe or repeated sexual harassment. 13% report sexual assault during their service. At the same time, another health issue involving women in the military has stayed mostly below the radar. That's the issue of intimate partner violence. A new report published in the Journal of Women's Health caught the attention of Sound Medicine's healthy living expert, Dr. Teresa Rohr Kirschgraber.
For so long, women, I believe, and men for that matter, have been not bringing it up, not talking about it, perhaps being embarrassed about it or upset that it could happen to them. So that when this came up, especially with some of the recent events that have occurred, and that we needed to be able to discuss not only military sexual trauma and violence, but intimate partner violence within a military setting. Yes, this is kind of a defined and a specific group, but I think that what we learn from these specific cases translates into other civilian activities.
An author in the Journal of Women's Health reports that at least 36% of active duty service women reported physical, psychological, or sexual intimate partner violence during their time in the service. Why do you think this has gotten such a lot less attention than the public discussion of military sexual assault?
Well, one, it's because victims, I think, get very concerned about how it's going to affect them, how it's going to affect their career, and that at first it can be very embarrassing that this is somebody who you trusted, this is somebody who you had a personal relationship with. And also, as women veterans, as women military personnel, the anticipation is that you can take care of yourself. So when this happens to you from somebody that you had a close relationship with, it's very disconcerting.
Is 36% a high number if you compare it to the general population?
Oh, it's a significantly elevated number. But what's more concerning is that the 36% is those women who actually reported it. And we know that it's not so much in the number of women reporting, but it's in those that didn't. So anticipate that that number is probably double or triple that. But one of the interesting things, too, is they recognize that in military personnel, there seemed to be a higher incidence of women who had had prior experience of abuse before they ever got into the military. And so perhaps doing more screening on the front end to then give support to those women who have been victims or have witnessed abuse in the past so that they are more able to recognize it in themselves or in their friends and to seek out help long before it gets to such a level.
What about the physical toll that this takes on women?
Well, you know what's really interesting is that there was a significant difference between what the military considers to be severe in terms of abuse and what civilian court systems see as severe. So, for example, if somebody has complained of an episode of physical violence, which included strangulation. Now, a person didn't die, wasn't permanently injured, but there was an episode in which a strangulation occurred. From the Department of Defense, that is not treated as severe abuse because for the Department of Defense, they require that for abuse to be considered as severe, it must result in a major injury that required inpatient treatment or temporary or permanent disability for that victim. So I got into a fight, my partner tried to strangle me, I got away, I survived. That is not considered a severe abuse in the Department of Defense, but it would be in the civilian courts.
I would imagine then we're talking about not only military women at higher risk for physical health problems, but also emotional and psychological health problems.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things. One of the highlights that the study kind of pointed out is that we do need to look at this from the very beginning, because if it's not treated and not taken care of early enough, then what happens is that the complications are so significant, not only with chronic pain, with drug abuse, substance abuse, homelessness. It impacts their abilities in such a great amount, even far down the line.
Do you see some reason for optimism in the future, since there is so much attention being paid to military sexual assault? Do you think it'll translate into intimate partner assault for these military women?
I think it is a great first step. Just the fact that military sexual trauma has been brought to the forefront, that it's being discussed, that it's not being swept under the rug anymore. Now, granted, there are still many cases that need to be further investigated, and we need more research on this. So, yes, I'm grateful that at least we're thinking about it and looking at it now. We need more. We need to identify the problem and discover the scope of the problem, in order to be able to then look at what gets the problem started, and therefore then be able to look at how do you prevent it from happening. The goal is not necessarily to always treat after the fact, but we'd like to be able to put some processes in place to treat from the very beginning to help prevent it from happening in the first place.
Dr. Teresa Rohr-Kirschgraber, thank you so much.
Thank you, Barb.
Dr. Teresa Rohr-Kirschgraber is with Eskenazi Health Center of Excellence for Women's Health, an associate professor of clinical medicine and pediatrics at the IU School of Medicine, and a regular contributor to Sound Medicine.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and your Sound Medicine stat for today is zero. So there's a phrase called leisure time physical activity. That means the moving around you do for fun, like golf or Pilates or doing CrossFit, and then talking about it on Facebook. These days, a lot of people seem to think that nothing's more fun than sitting down. A new study that examined Americans' weight found that the number of people doing no leisure time physical activity, or to put it in numerical terms, zero, has exploded. These days, more than half of women belong to the Zero Exercise Club. So do about 44% of men. These numbers have absolutely jumped, climbed, leapt since 1988. Figuratively, of course, not so much actual movement is going on. Over this period, people's daily calorie intake didn't change much. So based on this study at least, excessive eating may not be the cause of our obesity epidemic, but rather, too little of a bunch of other verbs. That was your Sound Medicine stat, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up, does a high-tech headband overpromise?
When it worked, it seemed to work well, but it didn't work well for a lot of people.
And later, a retired surgeon talks about dealing with the unexpected.
My hands were ice. I could barely tie my shoes. I could hardly swallow. I splashed water on my face, made it to my car, raced to the hospital.
You're listening to Sound Medicine. Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Let's check in with Jill Dittmeyer now for this week's health news headlines.
Thank you, Barb. A new study from the CDC finds young kids do eat their fruit and veggies, but once they hit those teenage years, it's a different story. Researchers looked at the eating habits of kids aged 2 to 19. 90% of the 2 to 5-year-olds ate fruit daily, but less than half of the teenagers polled did the same, including French fries, which researchers allowed to be considered as a vegetable in the study. And this week, the bioethics community weighed in on that kerfuffle at Facebook, which involved monkeying with users' news feeds to see how it might affect their posts. A lot of Facebook users complained that the experiment was an invasion of privacy, since they were not asked to be part of the experiment. A group of 27 bioethicists signed a letter in the journal Nature suggesting that people should just calm down. Dr. Eric Meslin of the IU Center for Bioethics was one of the co-signers.
In medical research involving human beings, our federal rules, which we've talked about here on Sound Medicine before, say that if you are an individual participating in a study and your name or your identity is known, then it's required to ask for your informed consent so that you won't be misidentified, discriminated against, or otherwise exploited. In the case of the Facebook study, no one was being identified by name. So in a sense, you might call it a technicality, it wasn't human subjects research because no one was being named or identified. So informed consent wasn't really required. Because someone can type their ideas into a text box doesn't make them an expert. On the other hand, it's their view and it should be treated as such. So the outrage, I think, sometimes can be a little overstated. This was not the Tuskegee experiment. This was not research involving human subjects where private genetic information was shared or laptops sent all over the place. So I do think a little bit of context and a little bit of perspective is important.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
Following up now on some health news from earlier this year, you may recall that the FDA made a pretty big deal with the announcement that it had approved a new treatment for migraines. It's called Cephalate, and it's a battery-powered headband that claims to prevent migraines through electrical stimulation. Our next guest has done a lot of work in the area of migraine prevention. Dr. Stuart Tepper is a professor of medicine and neurology at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine, and he's got a few questions about this device.
It looks like Princess Leia's tiara from Star Wars. It's a AA battery-powered electrical stimulator that is applied to the forehead using a headband-like device. And the way that it works is there's a self-adhesive electrode pad which is positioned over the center of the forehead, and then this device is held in place with the plastic headband that rests on top of the ears, and it activates a low-level electrical current that's supposed to stimulate the nerves of the head and those nerves that are supposed to be associated with migraine. And it was approved based on two studies that were conducted in Europe. One of them was done in Belgium and used 67 people who had at least two migraine attacks per month. They needed to wear it for 20 minutes a day, and then they were evaluated for 30 days to look for a change in monthly migraine days and also the percentage of people who had a 50% reduction in their monthly migraine days. And in the study, only half of them actually got real stimulation. The other half got sham stimulation. So that was really the main study that the FDA used to approve this. And then there's another study in which patients were asked after a period of time, would you buy one? You know, how satisfied were you? So those were the two studies, but only one really was a sham controlled trial, and that was only 67 people.
Well, and was it effective? I mean,
well, yes, it was effective, and that's why the FDA approved it, but it was modestly effective. So the first way they looked at it, which was change in the number of migraine days, showed some improvement, but it actually didn't reach what we call statistical significance. And the second outcome, which was the percentage of those who had a 50% reduction of migraine days, that was positive. And they did have a significant decrease in the number of headache days in about a quarter of the subjects, so about 26%. And so the way to look at that is if you just looked at total headache days, it probably didn't even reach statistical significance. But if you looked at the people who really, in which it really worked, in which they really dropped their migraine days by half, then a quarter of the people did have that outcome. So when it worked, it seemed to work well, but it didn't work well for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think I'm almost more interested in the second study about would you buy it?
Well, before we get to that, let me tell you one of the problems with this. They did the trial for 3 months, and people were supposed to do 90 sessions, right, every day, 20 minutes each. And the device allowed the company that makes it, Cephaly, to actually tell whether people were using it properly or not. And it turned out that a significant percentage of people during the study did not use it reliably, didn't use it for the 20 minutes every day. And that actually turned out to be a problem in the second study, which the one you're asking about, which is how many would buy it. So they did this large study with 2,300 people who rented the device for 40 days through the internet. And 54%, so about half, said they were willing to purchase it. 46% said they were not satisfied and returned it. So, and when they looked at the devices that were returned, only about half of the, less than half of the people that had used it had actually used it every day for 20 minutes. So what we don't know is if you actually use it according to the instructions and turn it on every day and keep it on for 20 minutes every day, whether there would be a greater likelihood of it working, and then you would actually want to buy it if you were a patient.
I'm speaking with Dr. Stuart Tepper about preventing and managing migraines. Dr. Tepper is a professor of medicine and neurology at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine. I was just wondering, in terms of just electrical stimulation as a way to prevent or treat migraines, how does that work?
Well, the idea was that it would alter the pathways in what's called the trigeminal nerve, which is the nerve that serves pain in the head. And by stimulating continuously at a low level, that you would reduce the likelihood that that whole pain system would be turned on. The good news on it, of course, is that the side effects were minimal. I mean, really, almost nothing. Less than 5% of people had any side effects. And you compare that to other drugs that the FDA has approved for prevention of migraine, like topiramate, Topamax. Well, Topiramax decreases the number of migraine days by 44%, and the Cefaly device reduces it by 25%, but topiramate has a ton of side effects for a lot of people. It causes memory dysfunction and numbness and tingling, and it can cause kidney stones, and the list goes on and on. And the general rule of thinking about Topamax, for example, for prevention of migraine, is that by 3 months, a third of the people are off it because they can't stand it. So this device, while its effects appear modest, its side effect profile is so nice that a lot of people are thinking, well, why not try it?
Yeah.
So I can tell you a little bit about what's involved in trying to access it, if you think
sure. Yeah.
The listeners would be interested. Well, right now, it's generally not covered by insurance. And so the way it works is a doctor provides a prescription, and it's called the Cefaly STNS device, because it's really a TENS unit at the forehead. And it costs about $295 plus $29 for shipping, with a prescription accompanying each order. When I checked on it this week, you also have to buy a 3-pack of electrodes for $25 and an additional $5 for shipping for that. And each electrode pad lasts 15 to 30 days, and the company doesn't accept credit cards and accepts payment at this point only through PayPal. So that's what's involved in ordering it. Sometimes insurance companies will cover TENS units, and so if the insurance covers TENS units, then they will probably cover this. But there's another kind of interesting aspect of the Cefaly device, which is that it's different in the United States from in Canada and Europe. So it's approved in Canada and Europe, and if you buy the Canadian device, which costs the same, that has three settings, and one of the settings is supposed to terminate migraine attacks, so it can be used acutely, and one of the settings, same as the U.S. setting, is for prevention of migraine, and one of the settings is for what they refer to as relaxation and stress reduction. If you buy the Cefaly device through Canada or Europe, you get the three settings. If you buy it in the United States, you only get the one setting.
So if you're going to buy one of these, in your opinion, if you want to try it out, it has 25% success rate, but like you said, no real side effects, would you go for the Canadian model, or would you go for the U.S. model?
Well, I think if you could go for the Canadian model, that would make sense. But what I've been hearing is that in Canada where you don't even need a prescription for it, the Canadian purveyors of the device are restricting it so that it's difficult to get it shipped to the United States. So I suspect the only way to get it is to go up there and actually buy it. I did go on the Costco website for Canada, and it's available there for $250, although it's on back order. So I think for listeners who want to get it without a prescription, and I would probably do the Canadian device and then get the electrodes through the U.S. with a prescription. It would give more versatility. But if they want to just do it the way the FDA evaluated it, then they just try it for prevention, and then it should be straightforward getting it with the all of the exceptions that I listed, price and insurance reimbursement problems and requirements for electrode refills.
Well, Dr. Stuart Tepper of the Cleveland Clinic, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been fascinating.
It is. It's a very interesting area that's changing very rapidly, and thank you very much for letting me talk about it.
Can how you get around have an effect on how you feel? A South Carolina researcher says yes. Jill Dittmeyer explains in this week's Sound Medicine Checkup.
Designing roads and sidewalks makes Professor Eric Morris happy.
I'm assistant professor of city and regional planning at Clemson University in South Carolina.
Keeping people happy who use them would make him happier.
So I primarily study transportation, and I also study cities and urban planning. And so I'm one of the early people to apply the study of happiness to cities and the way we get around cities.
Specifically, how we get to work, by bike, car, bus, or on foot. To do so, he studied a lot of data from the American Time Use Survey.
And they're very specific in figuring out what people are doing. We know if people were busy fencing or caving and spelunking, or, you know, there's something like 500 or 600 different categories.
Including transportation.
And in 2010, they did a special year-long well-being module where they asked people what emotions they were feeling during each activity.
Morris found bicyclists are the happiest commuters.
Bicyclists are very enthusiastic about their mode. In general, you don't bicycle around unless you have a pretty strong commitment to bicycling because it has a pretty high opt-in cost.
Bus riders are the least happy.
You don't feel like you're in control. You can't control when the vehicle arrives. It might be late. You have no control over this. You're not maneuvering the vehicle yourself. There are people getting on and off and asking the driver questions, slowing you down.
People who drive a car or are a passenger in a vehicle are in the middle, as are those who walk to work.
We suspect that it has to do with the fact that a walking trip can be very pleasant or unpleasant depending on the characteristics of the traveler and the trip.
Morris says in the end, happy commuters make happy cities, and isn't that the point?
If we're not building cities to try to make people happy, I'm not sure why we are building cities.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
Do you want to listen to Sound Medicine anytime? Sign up for our free weekly podcast. Click the box at our website, soundmedicine.org. You can also find us at iTunes, at Stitcher Radio, and at Swell AM.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Every once in a while, a guest on this program really makes an impact, both on us and our listeners. Dr. Sid Schwab is one of those guests. He describes himself as a mostly retired surgeon who now lives in the Pacific Northwest. He came to our attention because he's both a prolific and really elegant writer. I had the privilege of speaking with him earlier this year. So when we read a recent post about some of the unwelcome surprises that surgeons might encounter in the middle of an operation, well, this time Sound Medicine's Jill Dittmeyer jumped at the chance to speak with him herself.
Well, Dr. Sid Schwab, welcome to Sound Medicine.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And we're happy to have you back again. In our previous conversation with you, you were very candid with us and telling us about what it's like to do surgery, what it feels like to actually make that cut, open up that patient, fix those things, and then sew them right back up. But today we're going to talk about surgery in a different way, when the surgery fails, some of those bad outcomes. How often does that happen? When a surgeon opens up the patient and then finds that the disease has progressed or the anatomy has changed, how often does that occur and what do you do?
Well, you know, it's a lot less common nowadays than it used to be because we have so much better imaging techniques now that it's fairly rare. When I was in training, we used to do so-called exploratory laparotomies where we, you know, felt like we had to go take a look to see what was going on. Nowadays, it's fairly rare that you get big surprises about what's going on inside because patients have had an MRI or a CAT scan or something in many cases, but there are still anatomic variations that you can't entirely anticipate, and sometimes despite the excellent imaging, you can find things are different from what you expected. In fact, although I'm retired, I still do assisting on some big cancer operations, and it just happened the other day. We went in expecting to be able to do a curative operation and found sort of against the preoperative findings that the cancer really had spread beyond our ability to remove it, and you know, then you have to face the patient and the family and give them this really disappointing and completely unexpected news. It's pretty unpleasant.
That's writer and surgeon Dr. Sid Schwab speaking with Sound Medicine's Jill Dittmeyer. His recent blog post caught our attention, so we invited him to tell us the backstory and share part of what he wrote.
I have this recollection of having operated on a little baby, a situation called pyloric stenosis, where it happens in newborns, like about 6 weeks after birth, typically, where the muscle at the end of the stomach has sort of grown too fast and the stomach won't empty, so they're vomiting. And the operation is very simple. You just sort of cut that muscle and it opens up, but there's a possibility of leaving a hole in the intestine when you do it, and you know about it, and you make sure you don't, and if you happen to, then you put a little stitch in it and they're fine. But there's a danger of creating a hole in the intestine and not recognize it. You know, it's a little, somebody's 6 week old baby, proud, happy little parents, and you're telling them they need an operation. So I had done it on one little baby, and it went just as routine. And then I get a call about 2 a.m. saying that the baby had a fever and his abdomen was rigid, which can be a sign of infection. So I wrote this thing I'll read a little bit if it won't bother you. So I said, I'll be right there. I tell her the words, finding great resistance, barely squeezing out of my suddenly constricted throat. It's easy to describe how I felt because I felt that way again whenever I think about it. Had my wife awakened, she'd have seen me appear ghost white, I'm certain. My stomach was hollow. My hands were ice. I could barely tie my shoes. My hands were shaking and not following commands. It felt as if a cold hand were gripping my neck. I could hardly swallow. I splashed water on my face, made it to my car, raced to the hospital. As I drove, hands so tightly on the wheel that they were getting numb, I was thinking I'd do whatever was in my power to save the kid, do whatever it takes, never leave him until it was over, and then I'd never, never, ever do a pyloromyotomy again. And if he did poorly, I'd never operate again. This was a baby, somebody's precious baby. As I headed to the pediatric floor, I entered the baby's room. I saw the nurse standing by. I felt as if a million eyes were on me, accusing and hateful. And there he was, fussy face, flushed with fever, but moving around like a baby, looking not so bad. His belly was soft as, well, a baby's bottom. An x-ray looked fine, so who knows what it was. The kid did fine and went home as promised in a day or so. I drove home nearly limp, still shaking, barely able to control the car, wrung out like a wet sock. I lay on the bed exhausted, relieved but absolutely spent.
An hour or so later, I dragged myself to work. And the next time a pediatrician called for a consult with a kid with pyloric stenosis, I took a deep breath, considered it carefully, and said, I'll be right there.
Wow. How did you go about rechanneling that energy? I mean, you were obviously at one of the lowest points of your life, but yet you were able to bring that back up and go into that another surgery again.
Well, part of it was, of course, being greatly relieved, and I honestly don't know what I would have done if, in fact, it had turned out that I had injured that kid. And my God, if he had actually not survived it, at very least, I would have never operated again. And honestly, the kind of person I am, I might not have lived myself. I mean, I couldn't, to live with something like that, I don't know how people do it. I think some surgeons, now, you know, that's an extreme case. But it bothered me my whole career if anything was less than perfect. Even a little incision had a little spot on it that didn't heal just right. You know, that stuff bothered me like crazy. And yet other surgeons can say, and it's probably healthier, say, you know, I did the best I could, and that's the way it is. You want some kind of balance between driving yourself nuts over every little thing that isn't absolutely perfect on the one hand, and being so cavalier about it that, you know, hey, did the best I could, things happen, who cares, you know. You wouldn't want that surgeon. You probably, if you had to choose between the two, you'd want the one who drove himself crazy, but it made me burn out probably a lot younger than I should have if I'd been a little less demanding of myself.
Do you feel that many surgeons feel that same way as you did?
Well, I suppose closer to what I did than the one who would say, hey, you know, things happen. But I think maybe not all of them would drive themselves quite as crazy as I tended to drive myself. I would always, you know, when I would hire younger partners, I'd say, look, you know, give yourself a break, take some time off. Don't kid yourself that the world can't get along without you as a surgeon. So I think I took it to an extreme, but I guess, like I said, if you wanted a choice in the matter, you'd want the guy who took it too hard than the guy who didn't care, I guess.
Well, do you think surgeons are being prepared for some of these potential bad outcomes?
Sure. I think that's a huge part of training. In fact, I think that's a really a big part of surgical training, and I used to think, maybe it's unfair of me, that that was a critical difference between the kind of training I went through back in, you know, those long gone days where we sort of lived in the hospital and we were just, you know, we were treated, you know, if anything went wrong, man, we were castigated and it was all hung out like dirty laundry. What it was doing was inculcating, I think, a sense of limits and a sense of knowing when you're beyond your capabilities. You know, in the time when I was in training, I thought family practice docs, for example, got taught the exact opposite. They'd say, look, you know enough that you can keep your patients away from specialists as much as possible, and whenever you let your patient see a specialist, it's a failure. So that I saw a lot of people who were taken care of too long by people who didn't really know that they didn't know what they were doing, and I think that's a huge part of what it takes to be a good doctor of any kind, is not only teaching you so that you know stuff, but also making sure that you know when you don't know stuff.
And how about the patient? What can we do to be ready to help make sure there are no bad outcomes?
I think there's a few things, you know, that easier said than done. I think possibly the worst thing a patient can do to increase their risk of problems after surgery is smoke. And so don't smoke. And if you are a smoker, try to stop. You know, there's been studies that show that even a week or so ahead of surgery is better than not stopping at all. And if you need help, you know, with nicotine patches or whatever. So smoking is a bad thing. Being sedentary is a bad thing. So if you have the option, the time to do a little working out, but just simply walking. I think walking is the best thing you can do ahead of surgery, and being prepared to do it afterwards too. And then, you know, to be completely honest, it's surprising to me, you know, patients sometimes they're embarrassed to say that they, you know, smoke, or that they're, although it's hard to hide that, but, you know, they need to be upfront about the medications they're taking,
drugs, legal or otherwise. They need to be honest about that. And then, you know, follow your surgeon's advice, whatever they tell you. And you recognize, of course, that surgeons, you know, there's some people that feel strongly, you know, with their post-op instructions, and you could get 180-degree different instructions from patients. People would ask me, say, going home after a gallbladder operation, well, how soon can I have sex? And I'd say, well, I think you should wait till you get home.
So, some good humor and some good advice this afternoon. Yeah. Thank you for sharing your time with us, Dr. Schwab.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
Dr. Sid Schwab is the author of Cutting Remarks, Insights and Recollections of a Surgeon. We'll put a link to his blog on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org. And finally this week, the art of medicine, as taught in the Art Studio. Back in the summer of 2013, Sound Medicine's Sandy Robe reported on a unique art class in which the students were all plastic surgery residents, combining their scientific knowledge of human anatomy with a more aesthetic side.
When Dr. Rob Paul started medical school, he never imagined taking an art class. He says he also shied away from such courses in college in order to focus on math and science. But today, this Indiana University plastic surgery resident stands behind an easel at the Indianapolis Art Center, drawing on a large sheet of paper with a stick of charcoal.
Okay, that's time.
This class is actually helping because it's given me more appreciation for the fine details, and when we look especially at facial aesthetics, the shadowings and things like that that you know, we noticed before, but when you're really trying to draw that and depict that on a piece of paper, it makes you focus very, you know, heavily into that area.
Dr. Paul and a few fellow plastic surgery residents work feverishly to make quick sketches of a nude male model. They're capturing poses that change every 30 seconds. It's their warm-up before moving on to longer 15-minute poses, and then an hour-long drawing. Art instructor John McKee calls the shots.
All right, settling in. Just draw right on top of that. That's fine. Or off to the side. 30 seconds, and go.
It's McKee's job to teach the residents to get out of their comfort zone and try something new. Taking his cue from Betty Edwards' book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, he uses basic exercises to help students draw forms, look at negative space, and learn the difference between using vertical and horizontal lines. The exercises are designed to unleash creative potential by tapping into the unique abilities of the visual, perceptual right hemisphere of the brain.
I think just being able to see what's in front of them. I know that sounds basic, but really what being able to see what's in front of them and translating what they're seeing to what they're drawing. So that connection between their eyes and their hand, I think, is really, really important.
Since that's easier said than done, McKee leads by example. He steps up to an easel and does a demonstration for the residents. He shows them how to focus on finding the mass and main shapes and curves of the body.
So I'm just starting with the head and working down, just drawing over, because really this is a warm-up exercise. And I'm just wanting to see how you are seeing. So again, just kind of finding what the shoulders are doing, what the arms are doing, doing this quickly, working all the way down. And this is kind of a closed pose, so there's not a lot of negative space really to look at on this one, a little bit with his arms.
During the longer poses, McKee circles the room and offers individual critiques for his students, including Rob Paul.
But one thing I do want you to look at, since we have a couple of minutes, is the chin and the shoulder, and really just try to find that space. There's quite a bit of space in there, and right now the neck just kind of looks very full, yeah, like he's a linebacker a little bit. But this is really nice, and I think this is great. Wow, that foot's nice.
All right, thanks.
McKee admits that it's very difficult to draw the figure, yet that knowledge becomes indispensable when dealing with patients. After all, if a doctor can't draw an example of a procedure in front of a patient, it's hard to inspire confidence that things will turn out right during surgery. Dr. Allison Derrick believes she will put what she's learned into action.
If you're working on the face or on a child, detail is critical. So when you actually go to draw it, it makes you aware of all the little lines, every wrinkle, every crease, and you know, symmetry is key in plastic surgery. And so I think that will help us in the end.
Looking at things in three dimensions and translating them into a two-dimensional plane is something that second-year resident Dr. Christiane Ueno wants to improve through this class.
I need to work more on my proportions, and I still have a hard time with 3D vision, try to transform this into a 2D. It's getting better.
This class is the brainchild of Dr. Chris Jones of the plastic surgery group, Sandoz Jones Acker. It's the kind of instruction he wishes he had had two decades ago, early in his medical career. He says many patients assume that all plastic surgeons are born gifted artists, but that's not the case.
And we're just taught so much mechanical, methodical, left brain safe things, algorithmic best practice, that I think we're the ones who are maybe taught that we're not. And the art classes actually allowed me to begin to see myself like that.
Dr. Jones began his artistic journey by taking a metalworking class at the Art Center 9 years ago. His teacher later encouraged him to take figure drawing from McKee. He says learning to see as an artist has helped him improve as a plastic surgeon.
And then I began to notice in taking care of my patients, I was being able to step back from them a little bit and not see their illness or their malady. Just like John taught me to step back from my drawing and get out of myself and get out of the drawing even and look at what I was trying to draw. Just like that happened, I was able to step back from my patients and see the whole situation.
By drawing side by side in class over the weeks, Dr. Jones and the residents are accumulating a body of work, which they hope will ultimately translate to better work on a patient's body in the future.
I have 10 seconds left.
For Sound Medicine, I'm Sandy Robe.
Okay, that's time.
And that's it for this week's program. And if you haven't checked out our new Sound Medicine website yet, we hope you will. It contains a lot of health and medical news updated all the time, as well as links to our free podcast and a way to dig around in our archives for stories that we've aired in the past. It's all at soundmedicine.org. Plus, we're on Facebook and Twitter, so let us know what you're thinking and what you'd like us to cover on future shows. The senior producer of Sound Medicine is Nora Hyatt. Eric Metcalf prepares our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits the program and chooses our music. Jen Burnham manages our website as well as all things social media. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music. Our executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated. All rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.